Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You did not write Ghost Protocol.
Christopher McQuarrie is Tom Cruise's BFF when it comes to the movies. I don't think that they like vacation together. I don't think they're going to Maui. But Christopher McQuarrie directs like Valkyrie. He wrote like he's written a bunch of shits. But like
he wrote The Usual Suspects.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Is he an he's an Oscar winner for screenplay? I guess. Let me look it up
here. On his IMDb. Oh yeah. Yep.
But that's why I thought, so. It's such a wild card for me.
He Will Not Be Named wrote it. He
directed that guy directed it, but I am so Christopher McQuarrie won an Oscar for that. I am so fascinated that this action movie that people are saying is the next Mad Max Fury Road, that Ben was saying before we got on mic, sort of makes a case for the franchise that it's this amazing, one of the best action movies ever made, which you two just saw, is directed by that guy, the Valkyrie guy.
Yeah.
And that makes me even more excited about it because it's completely... I don't know how that guy does something titanic and amazing. Yeah. So I'm excited to see how it all comes together.
Have y'all seen Rogue Nation?
Rogue Nation.
It's very, very, very good.
Did he do Rogue Nation?
Very good.
On the record. I love Rogue Nation.
I think it's a great
The
movie.
Opera scene and the ballet. It's opera.
And Christopher McQuarrie has elevated Mission Impossible to the next level or
I agree.
Whatever.
What's interesting about the Mission Impossible franchise...
This
I guess
is also not
yeah,
the Mission Impossible episode.
Yeah, this is not the Mission Impossible episode, which is forthcoming, so maybe I won't say too much. But I love this franchise, and I think from the beginning it has elevated the idea of an action movie. I think that the first Mission Impossible, Brian De Palma, injects it with this attitude and with this theatricality where he's showing you the moving pieces, like showing you how the sets work. We'll talk more in the episode, but I think it is one of the best movies about the magic of movie the making.
That's Mission Impossible. I have a case for every single entry on why each one is worthy.
Hell yeah.
See you at the Mission
Okay.
Do you two have any vague thoughts?
Even the second
I
one.
I just have one that I think is absolute garbage is the second one.
Which is the John Woo.
Yeah.
I even can defend that one.
I saw Mission Impossible 2.
It's horrible, but I can
defend
it.
I don't even remember specifically. I'm sure it was like a sleepover or at a parent's party and the kids were downstairs watching a movie. I've seen MI2. I remember nothing about it.
So what's funny
is
that...
how I went into it.
The one I saw like in middle school and haven't seen since, I remember the most. I was like, oh, I remember.
It had burrowed
But Tandy Newton was faceless.
In your memory?
In my memory. But then once I saw it, was
when you say faceless, I'm thinking about a very specific scene from Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Sarah
she
Palmer.
Removed her face.
Oh, no. I thought it was
Laura?
The other woman that they find in the woods.
Angelina. Oh. Jane Addams' corpse. Or not her corpse, but the corpse that she...
The woman with, like, mouths for eyes.
Yeah.
Her. Now, we'll talk about this in the Twin Peaks The Return of... But this is so fun.
We're just teasing all of our future episodes.
Little teases, little morsels to lead you
what
to
are we here
the gingerbread house of the episode.
Talk
well,
about.
We'll get to that in a second in our own time. No need to rush it. But that's the same woman from episode 3, right? Yeah.
I
love.
The room.
The room in space.
There's a lake
space. Yes. I thought you meant episode 3 of the original run.
Which reminds me of Solaris. No. And then he climbs through, and then weasels his way out of electrical outlet.
It's that shot of Cooper inside Ben's gay face.
Exactly, inside on Ben's gay tongue.
Yes, that's
can you believe
Cooper
how long
lives.
Ago that was?
No.
That was like over a week ago.
That was exactly a week ago.
That was on Thursday? Oh, you mean when Brandon and I... ingenious.
Oh yeah, when you made the meme.
Yeah,
when you memed
when we
my
birthed
face.
The meme.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's retweet it from the account.
Let's do it right now. Let's just pause. Don't pause recording, but we'll just pause the conversation for a second
for you to do a retweet.
I'm Benji.
Oh, see, I'm excited about this because I about Fallout because I'm not the biggest Benji fan.
Ooh.
And
love Benji.
I don't dislike Benji. I just am not necessarily charmed by the Simon Pegg of it all. And I like Simon Pegg, but it's always felt like shoehorned in a way like Simon Pegg breaks in Shaun of the Dead and Spaced and becomes this new hot British comedian. And we're going to stick him into an American franchise as like a wisecracker. And I found that they haven't always known what to do with Benji, but
they work really well in Fallout. And it's very subtle.
Hell yeah.
They learn what to do with him.
I don't dislike it. I just think it's always a little clumsy.
Because he got introduced in what? Three?
I think three.
Because he's a JJ guy.
Right. So he gets introduced in three. They don't really figure out what to do with him until four. Brad Bird, they give him a nice role, I think.
It's been a while since I got ghosted on
we'll
the
talk.
Protocol. I need to put my cell phone on silent.
Silence your telephones, please.
That's what I've been... I've only said that about 10 times the past week to folks about silencing their cell phones at Outfest.
Yeah, what have you been busy with?
Well, I have been... In the midst of Outfest Los Angeles, which is the premier LGBTQ film festival in the world. Nice. And as I have mentioned on the program before, I program their short films. So I have been doing a lot of introductions for films and Q&A seshes afterwards. But before every film, I have to say, excuse me, we are at the cinema and we are here to look at this screen, not the screen in your pocket. So if you could just put your cell phones away.
How often does someone applaud that?
Not as much as I'd like, and that's what I'm gonna
those
work
are my
on.
Favorite people at the Arrow.
Yeah, fuck phones,
just like ostentatiously
yeah, turn
clapping.
Off the phone. Fuck it, fuck jobs.
My favorite was when Unfriended the guy introduced that screening and to talk about putting your phones away. He was like, "Put your phone away because you're gonna be staring at a screen."
Well, I said
the
that
whole time.
I said that before the Q&A or before the grinder, the looking for the.
Oh, you did, yeah. There are plenty of screens up here, folks.
So we don't need them in your pocket. I do have to share the one that I came up with today that I'm pretty proud of.
Nice.
And I only have two more opportunities to use it, which is, you know, put your phones away. Your Instagram story can wait, but this story on the screen cannot.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's beautiful.
You can only see it now, folks.
Good job.
Only see it now. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Priorities, am I right?
Priorities, IMO.
Okay, shut up.
Tell us about social media, Daniel.
In the film that we're discussing this week?
I was segueing.
Well, it's so funny. We all sort of naturally coalesced around the same segue. I heard Brandon say, okay, shut up, in my head,
in
after
mind,
priorities, IMO.
In your heart.
Priorities, IMO. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of...
I think... Are you correct, the host?
Correct. Because last week, you were the host when we talked
about
Lee
Notrasse. I just had assigned it to you, but then I was like, wait, is that correct?
No, and I'm glad that I'm the host.
It worked out.
And I'm glad that
it worked out quite nice.
Yes. We are here... Well, no, let's bring it back to one, T and you say. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Movies IMO. We are your three fave film faggots, faguitos, Fagissimo, and also I'll work on, I've got a pun for the movie. I'll work on it later.
Just fag.
Because
you get called a fag.
We're theater
grade.
Fags. Oh my god, we're theater fags in this
theater
episode.
Fags.
We are.
My name is Daniel Crook.
I'm Brandon Kirby.
I'm Ben Empey.
And today on the podcast, we are discussing Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade.
Correct.
I'm pausing for effect.
Bo Burnham, with his blonde hair, his man-child attitude.
He's the perfect fit to talk about the problems of being a 14-year-old on that level.
A 14-year-old boy.
We'll talk. No. We'll get into it. But I mean, do you want to start there?
Can I open with the critique that I wasn't going to put on the mic,
Hold on a second. Can I first just get... Okay, let's get two things on the record, and the second one is the synopsis. But the first thing that I want to get on the record is that... I'm kind of excited about this episode because it's a strange thing where this is one of the most highly acclaimed movies of the year, and on paper seems like the sort of empathy IMO vehicle that is just going to have the three of us fags gushing about its open heart.
And specifically for me, I love coming of age.
Yes.
I went into this expecting it to be number one on my list.
Well,
yes.
No, if I promise if you were introducing the movie this week, it would be your number one.
It is
one.
The least me
incorrect
movie out of the three of us.
And I feel like the most me. Mm-hmm.
I would make a case that it is the most me.
Actually, yes.
It is very much me. But so I'm looking forward to this conversation because I'm the only one here who actually likes the movie, and I don't just like it. I love it. I think it's one of the best movies I've seen all year, and I have a lot to say about it. And I'm so curious to hear what you guys didn't like about it. But before we get into that,
I was going to make my favorite joke, which is
make your favorite joke.
The concept, and then also the execution.
I just didn't like the film, for starters. Second of all, this movie is about Kayla. She is an eighth grader who is reaching. She's almost at graduation.
It's the last week of eighth grade.
It's the last week of eighth grade. It's sort of in that in-between place where she's about to permanently leave behind childhood and move on to young adulthood in high school, and it follows her attempts to make friends, to break out of her shell,
to express herself,
and to, and you know, we'll talk about this later and what maybe I'll agree with you guys on, but and her relationship with her father. But more than anything, I think it's about her relationship with herself and her surroundings. So we will talk over the next 3.5 hours, beat by beat.
Longer than Jean Dielman.
Yes. The themes, ideas, performances, mise-en-scène.
Textures.
Of eighth grade. Okay.
Wow.
Go for it, guys.
I love Enya. I love Sail Away by Enya so much.
Same.
I just have to say that. Well,
I love the use of it.
I'm happy to start there.
Great.
Because I think it sort of took my breath away when
The music cue?
The music cue, but not just the cue, what it was over. So there's this recurring motif throughout the movie where Kayla is permanently on her phone all the time, on social media, recording videos. It's obviously a haven. It's a refuge from the world around her. It's a place where she is able to disappear, feel safe, feel secure, and ignore the fact that she does not feel like she has any place in the world outside of her. So to use Sail Away as a music cue while we are just dissolving over all of these different shots of Instagram feeds, tweets, Jimmy Fallon videos, you know, YouTube videos, and her face, it creates this heavenly symbiosis between all of these objects and visually articulates in a way that I wasn't expecting in this film. When it comes to screens, I thought the film was going to have a fairly blasé approach to it.
It does. Bo Burnham.
He creates a safe haven. That's the end of my
point. Bo Burnham does. He's very good at using craft. And that's evident in his stand-up. It's evident in his songwriting. It's evident in this movie that he's very good at creating an emotional affect with the filmmaking. And that's one of the things that I liked about it. And while we're on the topic of the internet, I think that's probably the only thing realm where I have compliments to this movie, is the way that it deals with a person who feels like an outcast's relationship with the internet.
Yeah.
And it's something that I think we can all relate to in this room. As being Twitter faggots.
Yeah.
Twitter was there for me when I was at my darkest point in my life, and I was able to connect with other depressed people in a way that I had never had before.
That's how I felt about film forums and IMDb, and which now I'm like, fuck the IMDb top 250. But yes, especially at this age, I definitely disappeared into worlds on the internet to find safe space, to find community, while at the same time, when you're watching that sequence, you do eventually become numbed out by the nirvana of it all, which, as we have talked off mic anyway before, about what a numbing effect being ubiquitously upon the internet can do to your brain. It's a drug, exactly. And the Sail Away montage feels like, what's the word I'm looking for? It feels
high.
Like a high, of course, but that's not what I mean. We'll just go with high because I can't think of the more specific term. Yeah.
Euphoria?
No. It's like a drug term.
Oh.
Like when it first like kicks it.
I don't know.
Just like the rush.
The jolt.
What? It's not a jolt. It's like so peaceful and ephemeral.
Well, it depends on what drug.
I know, but I am having a hard time figuring out my word on it. So we don't know what kind of drug I'm talking about, but
I do like that about this movie.
And I think it uses screens really well.
Yeah,
and it's inventive and it overlays with images of her sometimes. And like we get this double exposure at one point. And
with her eyes.
Not just her eyes, but it like goes into different shots of her in bed.
Yes.
And it's like not just seeing the full screen. I'm motioning on Brandon's computer.
Yes.
We are doing close-ups on the screen itself. And it's much more visually interesting.
Yeah, I think as a document of like adolescents now in this digital age, like using Snapchat, using Instagram. Facebook is for old people, like that one character says.
I love that one.
I think in that very specific motive, it succeeds.
And it portrays world and addiction, frankly, without judgment.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's just like the nature of kids these days is that's what they're doing and that's what they like to do and that's how they connect.
Mm-hmm. And there's no moment where Kayla decides, you know what, I probably should put the phone away.
Yeah.
It's just part of her DNA. It's part of their DNA. It's part of the universe of the film. And it would be disingenuous for someone at some point to be like, frankly, like in the Edge of 17, my generation is so obsessed with their screens. And if it's not on their screens, then they don't care about it. Like, I love that this.
Does she say that?
She does say
I don't remember
in Edge of 17, which feels very inauthentic because it's like you're not outside of that, girl.
I have to say, right. I mean, rewatching Edge of 17, I still really like the movie. I like a lot about it. I liked it less. And after watching Eighth Grade, I like it even less, especially when it comes to the idea of Kayla being an outsider. And something that this film does when it comes to portraying an outsider in that junior high school space that I think is really admirable is there is no moment where she says, I'm an old soul, or I'm different than my peers. It is all through the performance and through the storytelling that we are able to capture her opposition to her environment and her peers. And there's no monologue where she's like, if only I could fit in and wear and straighten my hair and clear up my acne. Like in The Edge of 17, which is a very good movie, is so schematic.
Yeah.
And this film, and I'm sure that you guys don't like the structure of it, because I was doing a little bit of research just on Letterboxd before.
Of Eighth Grade?
Yeah, I guess some people don't really like the structure of
it. Well, I like...
What's there to dislike about it?
I think the first half is a bit of a tone poem, and like it just uses music and cutting and just performance in a very like just visceral way. There's no real plot for the first half, I think. And once the story and the plot starts kicking in and then the big turning point happens, that's when it loses me. It loses me in the script.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the first half is very, I don't know, just like mood, which I like.
I love how subjective.
I did for like the first half hour, I was just like, oh, maybe I am going to like this because after you talked shit for a week, I was a little nervous and I was just like on edge and like, I have to really try to like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then and then for like half an hour, I was like, oh, it's going to be easier than I thought to like this. But then it slowly lost me.
I mean, I think that when it comes to elements of form that you're talking about with the very aggressive music cues and the cutting and then some of these montages, like the one we've just mentioned with Inya.
The best eyes, boy.
Yes. It's
that scene.
That's probably the best part of the movie.
The film.
When that music cue hits. Boom! Oh, it's good. Amazing. I love that. I loved the movie that was happening.
But it's not only is it highly subjective in a way that I think really gets inside the head of this girl, but also is exactly how someone who spends all of their time on the internet with memes and short attention span, Instagram, ADD, that is how you would express that moment. Because it's not just that like boom, like of the music cue, which is very funny, but it's not just Bo Burnham trying to get a reaction out of the audience, like for a laugh with this aggressive techno music cue. Mm-hmm. That is the music in her head that she is accustomed to hearing on the internet with some sort of dramatic reveal. And then when it cuts off very jarringly quick. At first I was like, oh, I think that was a little too, that should have continued on for another 30 seconds. I'm not sure I like that. But that's because I'm coming at it from the perspective of a 27-year-old who has a, you know, our attention spans are shrinking, but I am able to, my point is that for someone of that generation, I don't think for a second they would be like, oh, that was a little quick. That was cut short a little bit. That seemed unnatural. You're scrolling between posts so quickly. Like, you only experience things for 5 seconds at a time.
The cutoff's perfect because then it blasts you back into reality and she's like, good job.
Yes.
It's perfect.
I want to say before we keep going, because about the film's sketching of the relationship between Kayla and technology, I think in the very beginning of the film when she's recording that video, and we'll talk about the videos later, and I'm sure that we will, we cut to a wider shot away from the computer in her bedroom.
I like that a lot.
And it is a completely dark room except for this one bright light that's coming from her laptop screen in the corner. And so you get this whole idea of she is in this nebulous, dark world that she can't see through. But in this spot right here, she can see right in front of her. She can be herself. She can see. Yeah. And I think that's a beautiful visual metaphor.
Yeah, I love that opening. Of the video and then pulling out to see that.
Yeah.
I mean, Elsie Fisher, she's incredible the whole movie, but I think specifically when she's recording the videos, that is a very specific performance tone to deliver, and she does it. And it's not improvised. That was all, like, I saw an interview with Bo Burnham. Those are all scripted, and she is following the script to a T.
The likes and the uhs.
The likes, the... Which, and the like,
holy shit. Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. The likes and the uhs. So I really did cry throughout the entire film. Like 10 minutes in until the end, I was crying every few minutes. I was moved by this film and moved by the performance and moved by the emotions that it evokes. But there was a moment later in the film where I just fucking lost it. And it's when you hear her listening back to the video she recorded for herself 2 years earlier in sixth grade to listen to in the eighth grade. Mm-hmm. She sounds confident. She sounds optimistic. She sounds poised. Mm-hmm. And to note, like, it's so easy to imagine, like, a very clean arc between being 6 years old and then getting up to 14. Mm-hmm. And it's not until high school that you really embody yourself. But something very smartly and subtly, or something that the film very smartly and subtly points out, is that junior high school, especially in the beginning of high school, is when you actually, for a lot of people, start to lose the confidence that you had as a kid.
Right.
And to hear it in the tremulous quality of her voice, how she is constantly shrinking inside of herself and scared of how she's going to sound, of how she's going to come off, which obviously I can relate to, because if you listen to this podcast, I correct myself mid-sentence every other fucking sentence. It's something that strikes me as very true about being that age and being unsure of how you fit into the world around you and wanting to impress people and wanting to put your best foot forward, but not knowing how and not trusting yourself to. Mm-hmm. And that sort of moment between her and her sixth grade self just wrecked me.
Yeah.
And is a very fine observation, in my opinion. And by fine, I mean like granular and fine.
Yeah. I think that all speaks to Elsie Fisher's performance, which there's nothing negative to say about it. It's amazing. She's incredible. She's, it's great. I just don't like the movie. Yeah.
I have a problem with her performance, but I don't think it's her. I think it's Bo Burnham.
Okay.
Which is, I often feel like she is giving the emotion that is needed to be telegraphed to the audience and not the emotion of Kayla in that moment. Does that make sense?
Well, that does make sense. I understand what you're saying. Go ahead.
I feel like she is being directed to do something that isn't, like, I didn't spend enough time to, like, think about what is the example of this, but it's like, I just feel like she's performing for an audience and not living the life of this character.
Which is what the character is doing, though, in these videos. I mean, I find, maybe be more specific, because I don't want to respond to something that you're not saying.
It's just, like, in every scene, I feel like she's trying more to telegraph to the viewer that she's awkward or she's uncomfortable or she's trying to seem confident or she's trying to do this more than I see the character trying to do that.
That's what I thought you meant. So this is a character who spends her time doing self-help videos on the internet for no one. And then later realizes maybe I should actually work on myself before I'm giving advice. This is a character who is in a way always performing, not in a ladybird kind of way. Most of the time she doesn't know, you know, she has like two left feet and she doesn't know even like how to make eye contact with somebody. But I think that especially when you consider the ways in which narratives on social media about power, about influence, I'm thinking like the Kardashians on Instagram, like the ideal of what normal looks like is also performative now, that it makes sense to me that in her performance she's emulating these abstract ideas.
But I don't think she's performing for the people that she's in the scene with. She's performing for the audience at home.
I understand the point, but I'm confused as to why it's a bad thing that she's making the audience feel something,
because I don't see her as being in the moment of the scene as a performer.
She's not. I mean, that's the thing about Kayla, is that she's never in the moment because she doesn't know how to relax.
No, but not about Kayla, about Elsie Fisher.
I'm saying that it feeds into the character for me. I think I understand what you're saying, but I like the fact that she's completely indecipherable in every single scene and people don't know what to do with her, even though to us, the audience, we get exactly where she's coming from. I think that's sort of the tightrope of the performance, that she is... People like her. Her dad likes her. Her teachers like her because she so clearly has like a pure soul. She just radiates that sort of empathetic glow. Mm-hmm. But her peers don't know what to do with her. When she's trying to forge a connection with them, they're completely blank on their face. They don't know how to interpret what she's saying. Mm-hmm. The fact that she's able to telegraph that in a way that I think is a believable dynamic, I think she's acting off of the people she's in a scene with, while also telegraphing to the audience where she's at in the back of her head, I really think is a tremendous, what you're saying is a negative, mm-hmm. I think is a tremendous achievement for a young actress.
Sure. I just think it rings false to me.
I hear you on that, but I just don't understand.
I'm unable to suspend my disbelief that this is a character and not a girl playing a role that has been directed poorly.
That makes sense.
I don't understand why it's a negative that Kayla seems completely uncomfortable or out of character every single time she's talking to another person in a scene.
No, it's not the fact
for like a 14-year-old, but for like a 14-year-old girl, I think demanding like clarity of character is beside the point. I mean, the whole fact is that she is...
No, it's not about clarity either.
Then maybe I'm not understanding your point.
It's... She's not giving me pure Kayla.
But she's not able to get... That's her whole struggle in the movie, is figuring out how to give pure Kayla.
No, but I mean, she's not giving me pure Kayla, unable to do that.
How do you feel about the scenes with Kayla when she's not acting against anyone else in a scene?
I feel the same.
So, but you're relating this to the ways that she's acting against other people in the scene. So,
no.
Okay.
I'm not.
Okay, that's what I thought you were saying.
Just in general, mm-hmm. her performance is for the audience.
It feels like a performance, not...
She's not... I don't see her living her life this way.
She's not living her life. That's the whole point.
Lived in.
She doesn't... She's not lived in.
But, okay, so then when she's alone...
Yeah, when she's alone on her phone...
I still don't feel...
I see it when she's alone on her phone and when she's recording these videos by herself. I do see pure Kayla coming out.
I still think she is doing something for the audience.
Well, I mean, she's an actress. Of course she's doing something for the audience. She's trying to make the audience feel something. I think that the fact she's able to do both really is quite remarkable.
But I feel like I can see the seams.
I mean, I see the seams of the character and that the character doesn't know who she is yet and that she is falling apart at the seams every time she tries on a different personality. That is a strength to me. That makes me think about how uncomfortable I was when I was that age and how I was trying to code switch between all these people and try and mm-hmm. put on all these different personalities. And like, you know, the scene when she sneaks over in the gun drill, which we can talk about that.
Oh, my favorite scene of the movie.
Yeah, we can talk about that. But when Aiden is like asking about blowjobs and she's like, oh yeah, I do. Or is that Edge of 17?
No,
that's it. Yeah, and she's like, oh, I do blowjobs. Like I was saying shit like that to people. And then another scene, like talking with, you know, some cool girl trying to explain the shitty gift I got her. Like right. she mm-hmm. is struggling to connect with everybody. Mm-hmm. I know we're just not going to see eye to eye on this, but I think that quality that you find inauthentic and transparently performative, mm-hmm. that to me is the face and the body and the language of a 14-year-old girl who is struggling with herself and struggling with her environment to authentically project herself. And the mm-hmm. fact that she is able to make the audience feel a pure emotion at the same time, I think really speaks to a preternatural gift that Elsie Fisher has on the screen. But maybe we should talk about something else because we're not going to agree on this.
I don't have anything negative to say about Elsie Fisher's performance, but I'm just not believing that Bo Burnham has burrowed into the mind of an eighth grade girl. I just am uninterested in what he thinks a young eighth grade girl is going through, specifically in the turning point.
The car scene.
Which is when the movie ended for me. I was like, this scene, I don't care what Bo Burnham has to say about a young female being in this situation.
What do you think Elsie Fisher feels about it? I find that kind of reductive in a way that I think dismisses a lot of the work that Elsie Fisher is doing and that Bo Burnham is doing. I don't dismiss the idea that Bo Burnham can't write for a 14-year-old girl because he's a 30-something-year-old man, or that I'm not interested in his perspective on it because he's a 30-year-old man. Because when it comes to her performance and what she's giving in every scene, reminds me of watching my sisters grow up. It reminds me of being with my friends who were going through similar shit like this when we were talking at this age, like what they were going through. Everything in this movie feels real to me.
It didn't to me.
And I know that's not what you're saying, but I don't think that it's fair to... I mean, most of the time, And the three homework films we're doing are all directed by women about young girls. And I think that that lends them something special, of course. But I think that in that car scene, which I think maybe we arrive at a little clumsily, I think Bo Burnham is making a similar point that Catherine Brier is making in Fat Girl. When it comes to the ways in which men, when it comes to the ways that men exercise their power and authority on young girls by pretending to be their friend and their helper when really they're just trying to get laid, that wolf in sheep's clothing manipulation.
Yeah. I just don't like the way the scene is used because it feels like he just took the easy route to resolution because the rest of the movie is her just deciding. And then she has the monologue with the dad. And everything that follows, that pivotal moment in the car, feels inauthentic. The entire dad monologue, I didn't believe a word of it.
But that has nothing to do with that scene.
I see, to me, that turning point felt like an easy route to get to the resolution.
I understand. Well,
I feel like
I'm going to be oppositional. I need to shut
up. I feel like Bo Burnham... just didn't know what else to do there. And
that's how I feel.
And therefore, sexual humiliation.
Would you prefer... Because what that scene is...
I'll tell you what I would prefer.
Okay.
I would prefer the focus on that very nice high school girl. She just vanishes. And it's replaced with this sexual assault. Why does she just disappear?
She disappears because there's no drama there. There's no conflict. The reason,
but there could have been.
No, and we can talk about that, but I, for one, find it less interesting to find out that a nice high school girl is actually going to be your rival, that actually she doesn't mean it.
Well, that doesn't even have to be bitch. The conflict.
No, but that's the point of this scene, it's a few things. One, it's that she's not the adult she thinks she is. Mm-hmm. Two, that as she leaves the safety of middle school, of being on the, you know, living in her online bubble, mm-hmm. that there are dangers as a young woman that you enter to once you are in high school and once you develop a body. And it's completely true to me, that scene. The idea that this nice guy is going to take advantage of her because she tried to have an aside with him at the mall. And he knows that, and because he's a man, I don't think it's much of a leap to say that he would be manipulative,
yeah.
that he would prey on a younger girl.
Yeah.
He knows that she feels safe, and he knows that she's so desperately trying to fit in with this group that he has a leg up on her, and that also she knows nothing. So he can tell her, you know, I'm trying to be the nice guy that hooks up with you or sleeps with you before some asshole does down the line, which is the exact same logic used in Fat Girl. So I don't understand why. Is it the plot turn?
I don't like...
Because when it comes to what he's saying, it's nearly identical to what Brie is saying in Fat Girl.
I like the points you're saying about what the character says, what the words that come out of his mouth about, like, I'm doing you a favor. That rang true. But I don't like how the scene is used in the movie to be a turning point for Elsie.
Yeah, for me, it's that... It's in eighth grade. It's a plot
or
device.
Or for Kayla,
it's
not
a bait and switch.
In Fat Girl, it is the movie.
Right, right. Well, I don't think that eighth
and
grade
that's
is.
A problem
but eighth grade is not only about male dominance
no.
and just like male supremacy. Which, if you're going to talk, I mean, I guess I just don't understand why it can't just stand as that point and not be what the entire movie is about when it comes to being a legitimate point.
Because it
to
feels
make.
Like a cheap, easy move to me.
I think it's a smart bait and switch. She's not looking for it because she's not old enough to know to be looking out for predators. She has a very juvenile look at boys, at love, at relationships, or just sex. When she's confronted with it in this way, which mm-hmm. comes out of nowhere because she's not looking for the signals,
yeah.
she doesn't know what to do. And also, I think that I love the way that scene ends. When she's just like, she shuts it down. Mm. She doesn't even go along with it. In so many other high school movies, she takes her top off and then covers her breasts with her hands
sure.
and shrinks in.
Yeah.
The character actually has a lot of agency in that moment. And so I don't find it offensive. I'm not saying that you're saying that it is, but I don't find it offensive that a male director is pushing this story because he's actually giving the female character more agency than I've seen in any other high school movie.
But it still destroys her emotionally.
Of course it does, because this is an opportunity when she realizes that the world that she is trying so hard to fit into, she knows nothing about. And that she has to work on herself and be present. And maybe instead of trying to make friends with all these older people, actually try and forge a connection with someone on her level. Mm-hmm. And
Sorry.
No, I'm talking so much. Please.
I think the scene could work if it was just implemented differently in the movie. Or just the way he uses the scene to... project to propel to the end of the movie. Just it rubbed me the wrong way.
It's
I don't know.
Cheap to me.
It's cheap. That's the only word cheap. That comes to mind. That it was a cheap, easy plot device to end the movie.
I mean, I don't agree. I don't agree. And I also don't think that that ends the movie. I think that you're giving it more weight than the film is giving it. It is certainly what sends her home mm-hmm. in a mess. But I just don't understand why...
And it's what makes her burn the box.
It's what, correct. It's everything else that happens in the movie is because of that scene.
No. It is because of all... It is not just the fact... like that.
That's the turning
point.
The
sequence culminates in that, but you're ignoring the fact that she is... I love the way that Bo Burnham directs the scene in the mall food court, the way that she is in this awkward position at the table and is in, like I was saying earlier, he's always framing her in opposition to her environment. She's, you know, if we're going to start with something I don't like, I'm not sure that I like that her dad is spying on them in the mall.
I hated that.
I don't hate it, but I think that you could have done something better with it. But that's a humiliation.
Again, that seemed like an easy choice to do that.
That's a humiliation. The other guy at the table calling her out for being a baby, that's a humiliation. The fact that she can't actually seem to connect with these two girls apart from like, you're really nice. I mean, she's an intuitive girl. She must understand on some level that they're patting her on the head. That's a humiliation. And then this is the last humiliation. That entire sequence is one of humiliation.
But by the when she gets in the car at the beginning of the car, she's definitely in higher spirits. Like,
yeah.
Like, the evening was a success, even though there were these humiliations.
Okay.
Why
is it cheap to expose that high school boys can be dangerous to young girls? How is that cheap?
The way it's used here.
As a bait and switch to blindside you with the character who's not looking for it.
Yeah, I just...
I find it, again, a very smart way that Burnham is able to tell this story subjectively and another way that he's able to get into her mind that it was jarring for me when it went that direction. And then I realized, why am I surprised by this? Why am I...
See, I wasn't surprised.
I was actually annoyed because I was like, oh, that's an easy thing to make happen.
It feels like
real.
The obvious scene.
But who... I disagree, but I think that this is a place where... The idea of like a script mechanic is so beside the point. And that's what I like a lot about this movie, is that scenes like where she's writing in her journal about like things I want, mm-hmm. or like when she's trying to date Aiden or when she's trying to make friends at the pool, none of these things are resolved because she's not brave enough to go forward and do them. The movie is smart enough to say that where most high school movies set up an Edge of 17, set up a series of agendas that our characters are going to spend the rest of the time very methodically and mechanically working out.
Right.
This movie is smart enough to know that most eighth graders, unless you're hot or a jock, aren't actually going to possess the bravery to take that all the way.
Yeah.
So I think that a lot of the supposed objectives are stymied left and right in this movie. And I think when it comes to this scene, it's just like, it is the crystallization of her realizing that all of these things that she thinks are going to happen are not going to happen the way that she thinks they are. Mm-hmm. And until she takes a step back and realizes that she has a lot of learning to do, which involves stepping outside of her box for sure, but not growing up too fast, that she realizes the best foot forward to go into high school.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to see eye to eye on this. Mm-hmm. I completely disagree. I think that it's actually, for if we're going to talk about like a man telling the story of a 14-year-old girl, I think that Bo Burnham very smartly exposes the danger that young girls have when it comes to sexual assaults or just being preyed upon or gaslit or manipulated by their male peers.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it's a bit of a turn, a sudden turn in the plot, which I think is a really smart call because, like I said, she doesn't see it coming. I know, Ben, you said that you saw it coming. I did not see it coming.
The minute they like have their moment at the table.
I didn't know. I didn't see that.
When he wanted to drop her
off second.
Second.
Yeah. I didn't. Well, either way, if it's when he gets in the back of the car or when he says, I want to drop her off second. Of course, I knew at that point. What I'm saying is that we know to look for these red flags, but when it comes to what the camera is lingering on, we are able to pick up these social cues, but I don't think that the filmmaking is telegraphing it. I think that we as adults are able to pick up on those red flags in a way that the character isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just think there are better ways to tell this point.
Yeah, okay. That's how I felt. I just didn't like the way it was used.
Okay. I mean, I'm not sure how another way that you would make the point of your classmates may try and rape you or manipulate you. I'm not sure I'm not sure there's like a better or worse way to do it in this way that works perfectly fine, in my opinion.
See, and, that's the difference.
Yeah.
It works for you.
Yeah, it works for most people. But I understand your point. What's next?
I just wish I saw the movie that the critics saw.
I saw that. I mean, I haven't read any of the reviews.
I'm thrilled that you saw the movie they saw. I wish I saw it. Let's talk about the things we liked. I like the shooting drill scene a lot. I like when she confronts the two girls at the end. And she like tries so hard to look at them, but she still
but she can't do it.
But she still just stares at the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like those scenes a lot.
I don't like the mean girls, and I don't like
the one scene where they're on their phones was a bit too like okay. Well,
I've said before, I hate movies where some people have a soul and not everyone has a soul. You have to pick one. Either no one has a soul or everyone has a soul, and I don't like the way that. We are asked to, I just think there's a way to show mean girls and such without completely devoiding them of humanity. And I think that makes the film not empathetic overall because you are denying humanity to half of the characters in the movie.
So you're saying that the mean girls didn't get a fair shake?
That's not my point. I'm not asking to like the mean girls. I'm asking to show them as human beings.
I think we do see them as human beings. In the pool scene, before she goes in, we see everybody having a great time, connecting, being loving to one another. You do see it. I completely disagree. I also, when it comes to like my own junior high experience, mm-hmm. I remember plenty of times trying to talk to somebody and straight up wouldn't make eye contact with me. I remember being at parties where I decided I'm actually going to take a plunge. I'm going to do karaoke or I'm going to sing. I remember playing with my band at some, like at this one pool party, like having to summon
up
the
courage. You had a band?
Yes, I had a band in middle
school. Let's stop and talk about that.
Well, can I just finish my point and then we can talk about it? I know what it's like to summon up the courage to talk to somebody or to perform. Mm-hmm. And then once you do it, it's not the movie moment where people see your humanity and then look at you. No, people still continue their conversations, actively avoid your gaze. And then once you're done, don't comment on it to you. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to like these girls being on their phones, reads as completely true to me on that level. We didn't have cell phones when I was in junior high.
Right.
But if people had had cell phones, they would have been looking at that instead of looking at me. And I
just think you can be mean in a vulnerable way.
But that's not what the movie's trying to do. The movie is a subjective telling of how she sees the world.
Yeah, I guess. And I just don't like that, I guess. I just don't think that's a successful directing tactic.
I think it's pretty fucking brilliant. And not just in the performance and not just in the script, but again, the ways in which he frames her in these scenes, the way that he uses the zoom, for instance, at the pool party, and most of the times...
Pool party scene is incredible.
No, but when the shot starts on her behind the glass door, she's occupying most of the frame, and it zooms out more and more and more, and we see everything that's going on, like all the kids playing and everything, and she becomes so minimized and oppressed by her environment. Mm-hmm. It's this idea of being ready to take that step, and then actually the consequences of what's going on start to set in.
Yeah.
And how overwhelming and stressful and scary it is. And then when she finally gets in the pool, it's like a fucking war zone with kids jumping in and the balls going in. This is an example of why it's such a great subjective film. Because if you were to take it in a less subjective way, you don't mix somebody jumping into the pool or a splash as something that sounds like gunfire or a bomb dropping rather. And I don't think you can have it both ways. If you're going to have a scene like that, and if you're going to tell this story through this girl's eyes, then I just don't think it makes any sense to try and not, I don't want to say humanize, because actually, like I said, I do think that it humanizes those characters plenty. I don't think that the movie needs to go out of its way to prove that the mean girls are people too. I think that the movie depends on us as people to know that they're people too. And then also when we catch them, when she's not interacting with them, like in the beginning of the pool party, we see that they are capable of joy and fun and sharing moments with people. It's just whenever she's talking to them, they're completely disinterested in her.
It's like when the lead mean girl opened the gift right before Kayla's gift. She's like really excited about whatever cute shirt she got. And then she's like, what's it from? It's like,
and I've had that experience when I was a kid. showing up to parties that like either my parents were friends with them or like, or we were all in the same class. So like I was going to go. It's not like people hated me, but a lot of people weren't really interested in getting to know me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, what the movie is with Kayla. They're not saying that these people are monsters who are irredeemable. They're saying that they don't want to get to know her.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's a lot of what the conflict in the movie is her trying to be recognized and seen and learning how to express herself.
Going back to that pool scene, That's definitely the scene people are pointing to when they compare this to... Everyone's been saying, this is like a horror movie. That is a horror movie.
That is a horror movie.
When that zoom you're talking about, the zoom out and that whatever music is playing.
It's aggressive.
It's scary.
But I was
it's
in actually a band. Scary.
Let's talk about that. When was
Wait,
it?
Can I
and
say...
what did you play?
Okay, talk about the band, and then I want to say...
I mostly was the lead vocalist.
Nice.
Shut up.
Really? I wrote our songs, nice. And occasionally...
What was it named?
We had a lot of names.
Oh, good.
We were the New Episodes was the nice. One that we re- oh. was the one that we recorded under. Oh, no. We recorded under The Episodes, and the name of the EP was The New Episodes.
Nice.
We also were.
When was this? Eighth grade?
No, this was seventh and eighth grade.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
At another point, we were called.
Do you have photos from Adobo? This era?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm sure that my parents do.
Hell yeah.
I wanted to call us The Plastic Minutes.
Oh.
Which is so dumb.
Deep.
I know, makes no sense. But yeah, we were called The Episodes. And occasionally I would play keyboard on some nice. Songs. But
you did vocals. What kind of music was this?
Rock and roll music.
Just like that.
Nice.
Thank you for being a friend.
Oh, so it was like nice. Classic, like emo.
No, I'm kidding. No, it was me. I mean, it was emo that I was pouring my heart and soul into these performances and being really sweet with my singing.
Oh, nice.
God. Yeah.
Do you have recordings? Do you have like.
Do you still have these EPs?
Do you have them somewhere?
A singular EP. I think my brother probably.
I think
does.
We have to close out the episode no. with a song.
Track. I will try and. No, I don't. I can't. This episode.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Drops in 2 days. There's no
oh,
way.
Oh, you're right.
It. I
well,
can't
we'll do it.
It
in a later episode. Yeah. As a fun
we did an
tease.
REM cover. Oh, get this. Okay, so not to get too regional, but I wrote a song called Fred 62 when I was 13 years old, or 14 years old, one, based on the restaurant Fred 62 in Los Feliz, which is down the street from where my uncle lived when I visited L.A. as Elsie's age, or Elsie, as Kayla's age. And,
I know, I keep doing that.
And then I wrote a song, but not to get too regional, about the restaurant Fred 62.
I keep flipping Elsie and Kayla.
Oh.
Anyway, yeah, that was the band.
Can I say one final... I'm done talking about eighth grade, but...
No, this is what I was saying before we recorded. I have so much to say, but I think it's going to be a short episode.
Well, we have homework to discuss. I just want to say the one thing that happened in this movie where I was finally like, fuck this movie.
Okay.
Let's hear it.
It's when Bo Burnham makes Kayla a Rick and Morty fan.
Wouldn't she be?
No.
And a
a
14-year-old who lives on the internet. There's your balance, Brandon.
I don't know. It felt very Bo Burnham projecting his own interests.
Rick and Morty is so internet culture. By the way, Bo Burnham is an authority when it comes to talking about internet culture, mm-hmm. about talking about YouTube. Bo Burnham is an authority on this.
Yeah.
You have to. I mean, this is one place where it's
I agree with Brandon on this.
Why is it weird that she's a Rick and Morty fan?
It felt like she was a mouthpiece for Bo Burnham in that moment, and I didn't like it.
But last year, when like, I mean, Rick and Morty is a toxic fan base. It's mostly men, and it's, you know, there's like a lot of MRI.
I guess
that's
what I associate it
right,
with.
That's right. What I was
so
associating.
But do you think that a 14-year-old girl does who spends all her time on the internet, and Rick and Morty is
Yeah,
a
but what
like,
she's watching is like makeup tutorials.
Yeah, but she's also looking through memes, and she's also on Instagram. Like, Rick and Morty is very highly shared in memes, in GIFs, in reaction. Like,
I don't know if she's trolling Reddit.
You don't have to be on Reddit for Rick and Morty to pop up. I'm not on Reddit, and I see Rick and Morty shit on my timeline and on Instagram all the time.
Oh, really?
I shouldn't say all the time, but
I must.
Rick and Morty
filter properly.
Rick and Morty is one of those shows I've never seen, and yet I feel like I've seen every episode. Just like with Avengers: Infinity War, I've never seen it, but I feel like I've seen it 10 times at this point.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know a Rick and Morty reference other than the Szechuan sauce.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean,
and I'm on the internet a lot. Is what
I mean.
I'm saying.
I believe.
Are you on the same internet as a 14-year-old girl? Are you watching
Maybe.
Are you
I'm
watching
a homosexual
are you watching
male.
Are you watching Jimmy Fallon videos on YouTube?
No.
Well, so, she is.
They pop up.
This is what I'm saying. Like, we're all on the same internet, but it's all self-selected.
I would have believed it more if Gabe brought up Rick and Morty and she was like, haha, what's that? That I would have believed.
I think she would at least know what it is.
Well, but I don't think she would watch it.
I feel like she would have been like,
she's curious. A girly girl.
So you're saying girls can't like Rick and Morty?
It's just because I associate it with the toxic male fan base, my conception is no.
That women are fans of Rick and Morty too. And it makes a lot of sense that a teenage girl, who it's also like, what is it, like Adult Swim or some shit? Like, that's edgy.
Sure.
Especially to teenagers. I remember like Aqua Teen Hunger Force and shit like that when I was that age. It's like, that was cutting edge content. And if you knew anything about it, it was very
Aqua
cool.
Aqua Teen Hunger Force.
I do too. It's great.
I don't know.
A trenchant critique of the Bush 2 years.
Mm. I didn't mean to divide the table one last time, but I just, that rubbed me the wrong way.
No, I was rubbed the wrong way. When that reference came up, was I like, God, I wish you had talked about Futurama instead? Sure. Did it read as inauthentic to me? No.
It did to me.
But only because we are adults who have
suspended your disbelief.
No, I believed it.
That's what suspension of disbelief
means that I'm going to take away the things that are going to cut at what they're saying, and I'm just going to go with the direction of the movie. It's not even that. I feel like it's very organic for a teenager who spends all their time on the internet to know what Rick and Morty is.
Yeah.
Or, by the way, she doesn't
know what it is.
Why can't she be a fan of it? And also, it's not like...
I just don't believe it.
Okay, I don't believe it.
I believe it. We guess we won't agree on this.
I love not agreeing.
No, it's fine. I mean, I honestly... No, I don't need to go. I don't need to go in that direction. It's fine if you guys don't like the movie, but I don't need to. I'm going to end up saying something I regret,
and by not trying to chastise us for not liking it.
I'm not going to chastise you. I'm just sort of baffled in a way as to why you're trying to tell the movie better what 14-year-old girls know on the internet. Just because you have your own loaded perception of what each of
these things are. You keep saying knowing, and it's not about what they know.
Enjoying, consuming, choose your word.
I'm just saying it's a different situation.
Okay, but respond to what I'm saying instead of the word knowing. Consuming, watching, enjoying.
It matters. It's a different word. It's a different meaning, and I'm not being pedantic, but...
Well, then let's reverse. Put in T and U C. Mm-hmm. And pretend that I said consuming. Now respond.
No, that is right. I don't know. But based on what the clues that this movie has given me about what else she consumes, mm-hmm. my belief is that she wouldn't. These things don't feel similar to me.
So she can only have one set of interests, is what you're saying. It's either makeup tutorials or Rick and Morty, but it can't be both.
It's just how movies work.
But this... Who gives a fuck how a movie works? This is about the interior life of a 14-year-old girl. Fuck movie conventions. Fuck the idea of Edge of 17, where it's a very linear progression of how this girl is going to achieve what she wants in high school.
Well,
fuck
I don't
all
like that.
That
movie that much either.
No, I'm not saying that you're defending that. I'm saying that if you want to talk about movie logic mm-hmm. versus the universe of this film, I would say that Edge of 17 is a pretty good example of a schematic coming-of-age story mm-hmm. where all the building blocks fit together very nice and neat. And in this film, it is much more of a fog. Like I texted you guys, I think this movie captures the fog of war between being a child and being a young adult. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why the film doesn't have a linearity to it when it comes to its or a single-minded clarity about every single emotion. It's because she doesn't know how she feels. She's trying to learn. And so much of the movie is about her getting to a place where she can learn. And I'm also like, I just, you know, I'm a fucking sucker for movies about young women learning to learn about themselves. Mm-hmm.
I mean, very much same.
Yeah.
And I wasn't won over.
I mean, I don't know what else to say.
Same.
I truly don't know what else to say. I mean,
well, it's okay. No, you don't have to keep defending it.
I do have to. Okay. No, this is what I texted. This is a podcast where we give our opinions. It is literally my job in this moment to defend the movie. And on top of that, I just think that Bo Burnham is a really smart director.
On the way home, I yelled to no one, Bo Burnham is not a smart man. I'm not even kidding. Great. I hate him.
I think, what do you hate about him, Ben?
Everything about this movie is cheap to me. The writing is so cheap.
What's cheap about it?
The way that I'm asked to believe that this girl behaves. It's totally inauthentic to me.
No, you're asking for a fully formed character who behaves consistently.
No, I'm not.
Then what are you asking for?
I am asking for someone that feel, I like, I don't see like the deep struggle in her.
How can you miss that? I mean, every time she opens her mouth, it's word vomit.
It's just
she starts to say something and she takes it back. The way that she hunches her body together when she's walking in that swimsuit into the pool, like, how do you not, I don't understand.
It just feels so obvious.
I'm sorry that it's obvious that 14-year-olds have a hard time being themselves. I mean, it's an important story. I think it's completely unfair to disregard it because you think it's obvious that she's the awkward girl. I think that's erasure. I'm not gonna say this reminds me of something else that people complain about when they see archetypes in other movies and they're like, oh God, another fucking archetype. There's archetypes for a reason. There are awkward girls who are going to see that, and awkward is such a dumb catch-all. Like, what's the new girl thing? She's quirky or whatever.
Adorkable.
Yeah, fuck that. Forget awkward. She hasn't fully come into herself yet, and she has social anxiety. She doesn't know how to get along with other people, not because she's not an agreeable person, but because she doesn't know how to talk to them. So that's what awkward means in this situation. Someone who doesn't know who they are, doesn't know their environment, and it feels like their environment is working against them, no matter how much positivity they try to push into it. I'm sorry that feels a little trite. I don't think that at all. I think that this film breathes life into that archetype in a way that, frankly, I've never seen in a coming-of-age story, at least in the past 10 years. I think that this is one of the best coming-of-age stories I've ever seen in my entire life, and I will And Elsie Fisher gives one of the most tremendous performances I've seen this year. You can't topple Binoche. I was thinking of like, is she my favorite? It's like, no, you can't topple Binoche. Mm-hmm. But I think that this film actually beats back the idea of the stereotype of who this character is and actually gives a vividly sketched look at what the disaster of clarity in her head looks like. Mm-hmm. I feel very strongly about it, obviously. Mm-hmm. I relate to it very strongly. And more than that, it reminds me of watching my sisters grow up. And I just don't think that... This kind of character never gets the space that Bo Burnham gives her and that Elsie Fisher takes her in this movie. They are made to be a punchline or a supporting character or a best friend. And I think that it's liberating. I think that it's important. I think it's beautiful.
My final thoughts are... the performance is great. The direction is great. The script is not great.
I think the script is pretty genius when it comes to the lack of resolve that all these things it sets up, because the lead character doesn't possess the bravery or the passion that she thinks she does. And therefore, we never actually see the scene where she tries to go on a date with Aiden, mm-hmm. you know, and then he's like, well, you have to blow me, which is what Edge of 17 does. I think that the resolve with the father is really beautiful, and what she is saying about how, like, if she had a daughter, she wonders if her daughter would like her, and that is heartbreaking. And mm-hmm. I think it connects to the fact that her mother left at a young age, and you get another idea of like the formative trauma that's in this girl's head. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I'm sorry you guys didn't like the movie as much as I did.
Like I said an hour ago. I walked into this movie, movie expecting it to be my number one.
Great. I mean, it's not my number one. It's not. I think it's right under Let the Sunshine In. And it's funny because like seeing Let the Sunshine In is such an experience for me because I feel like I'm being read as an adult, but I watched this movie and it's so cringeworthy to me because it makes
child.
Me feel like a 14-year-old. And not because a man wrote it, but because I think a lot of those emotions are universal. But I think that when it comes to the specific dynamics of gender in this age group, I think Burnham nails that too. And I think that Elsie Fisher nails it. And I'll say one thing, just a point I want to make, and then we can talk about homework. Something you guys don't want to talk about this movie anymore.
No.
But something that I know. That's why I'm trying to wrap it up. I appreciate the ways in which Bo Burnham, through form and through framing, is showing how Kayla is able to actually harness control of herself through these videos. And also, pin in that, I also love the ways in which we use the videos as voiceover to drop out of scenes where at first I really actually just want to hear what she's saying to these characters. I want to hear her perform the song. I want to hear her dad talking her down. But by using that monologue from the video, I think that he very brilliantly illustrates the ways that she has distanced herself from her real world versus these self-help videos that she puts out. You know, there's the one where she's like, you know, I had a party and this weird girl came over. Like, she's totally taken the identity of someone else in all of these. And by the time when she stops doing the videos, it's not because she doesn't have love to give or isn't an authority. It's because she realizes that she is using it as a distancing mechanism from her real life. And I'm sorry, now I'm getting back to the thing and then I'm done. The way in the very beginning we start like on her face and then we zoom out and it's this idea of her losing control of her environment and where she is in it. And as the film goes on, we have like that shot in the pool and we have, I think in the high school visit, like this repeated like Barry Lyndon. It's not what he's referencing, but, like the Barry Lyndon like on the face and then zooming out onto the environment showing how dwarfed and how helpless this character is. And then at the end of the film that he pushes in on her, on that video to her future self is beautiful to me. And also the ways in which he frames her shooting the videos and that she seems to lose herself behind the screen as it goes on and becomes less and less herself. So anyway, I love the way that zoom sort of puts a period on it. For the love, and I've enjoyed the conversation. I'm sorry. It's been a weird 24 hours. It's been a weird 24 hours, but if anyone wants to talk to me and love on the film, I'd be happy to chat with you. Not that I haven't enjoyed this very much, but I would love to actually just.
No, you haven't.
No, I have. I'm kidding. So if anyone wants to talk about it, let me know.
All right. Stop. No, I'm just kidding. We have homework.
Where do you want to start? Oh, it's my week. So we are talking about three high school films that focus on young girl protagonists. We are talking about Mariel Heller's The Diary of a Teenage Girl, Catherine Brier's Fat Girl, and, oh my God, Kelly Freeman Craig's The Edge of 17.
Let's start with Diary of a Teenage Girl because, Daniel, I get to scoot to your side of the table.
Oh, no, I'm not even.
And defend against.
I'll let you start because I'm pretty spent. I'll jump in when I can.
There are things I like about it.
When I first saw Diary of a Teenage Girl, it threw me flat on my back. And I.
Helpless, tender, open.
And I rewatched it, wondering if I was going to feel the same. And it just floored me, threw me, it knocked me for a loop.
Knocked you for a loop.
All over again. Nice. I think the casting of this movie is such a miracle. Kristen Wiig delivers her best performance. Bridesmaids is
Welcome to Me.
I would say it's Welcome to Me.
Oh, Welcome to Me.
I think
among her best performances.
I think Alexander Skarsgård is tremendous in this
movie. Incredible. And then of course Belle Polly's amazing.
Oh yeah, she's the best.
I don't know. I think this movie's just such like breezy feminism in a very interesting way. It's I don't know. I just love the color palette of the whole movie.
The period that it evokes.
Yeah.
I think that it's remarkable the ways in which it takes a young girl's sexuality and ownership of her sexuality seriously while never shying away from the fact that she is being raped.
Right.
Like that she was being manipulated by an older man. And yet that doesn't mean that this character isn't going to feel sexually liberated on some level because she's too young to fully realize what's going on. It's not a good thing,
right?
But it's provocative and I think really important the way that this film takes that relationship to explore and the way that Belle Pally's character, whose name is, I didn't have time to rewatch it before. It doesn't matter. The ways in which she experiences ecstasy and similar to eighth grade thinks that she's growing up when in reality she isn't, and in this case is being taken advantage of in a really ugly and gross way. But that it takes her sexuality seriously.
Yeah. That she
Without shaming her.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's I just love any story about female sexuality. Mm-hmm. And just it gives her all the power and she's taking ownership of her own sexuality, even though, like you said, she is being abused. I think that's really powerful in the way it uses that.
I hate the animation stuff.
Why?
I hate it as a subplot. I hate the device in the mise-en-scene. I don't know. I just don't like it.
So you would like it if she was just sketching and we only see it on the page?
Yeah.
Interesting.
That it becomes part of the film.
Yeah, I hate it.
Floats.
I think that it's a great way.
With feathers.
I think it's a great way of bringing her safe space to life and what she does in order to have friends, have a hobby, in order to feel like she has some place in the world. And allies on her side, because her mom loves her but isn't really a great friend to her. I think bringing the feminist scholar, whose name I can't remember. But bringing her to life, walking together down the street, I find it beautiful. And I like the animation style. And that's another way I think this movie is totally distinctive and quite visual. In terms of story that doesn't necessarily need to be visually out of the box into something explosive with not just creativity, but the blossoming of this young girl's soul, even though it's very tricky. I like it.
I like it too.
But I think Kristen Wiig is outstanding in this movie. I love the way that it brings... I mean, it's like Zodiac level for me. I mean, this movie is not as good as Zodiac, but it's Zodiac level when it comes to evoking the San Francisco of yore. And on one level, it's even more tactile than Zodiac, as most of Zodiac is created in a computer. And I love the color palette. I love the muted Jimmy Carter era of it all.
Yeah.
Just the whole movie feels like it takes place in a hangover.
The third act of the movie really drives the whole thing home.
It's a horror movie.
Yeah, when it turns and she has the fling with the other girl, which really drives home the fact that she is in charge of her sexuality. She's going to sleep with this, be swept up by this woman and fall into drug dens on accident. She leaves and now I forget how the movie ends, but I think it ends around there. She reunites with her mom. I think it's really beautiful, the whole thing.
Kristen Wiig slaps her across the face.
Right. Which I slaps love. And then hugs, which she deserves a little slap. Well, no. She ran away.
She does, but I like that the movie, which is really so much about Minnie, focuses on the hurt that her mother feels in all of this. I mean, she has been betrayed on some level. I mean, she doesn't like her mom, but sleeping with your mom's boyfriend, even if you're of legal age, is still a pretty shitty thing to do.
It's pretty fucked up.
I love the scene, and it was in a hotel or something. In a lobby of some sort.
It's
been 3 years since I've seen this movie.
Oh, when she's like, well, you have to marry my daughter.
I love that
scene.
Yeah, it's a great scene. Yeah, I love this movie. I don't have much more to say.
I'm sorry I didn't have time to rewatch it, but I'm kind of glad I didn't because then I'd just be talking more about it. But I will rewatch it. I loved that movie.
It's a good one. It was my number three that year. Four, I don't know.
It was my number three.
Fun.
You guys.
Oh. What else are we talking? Edge of 17. Woody Harrelson's best performance.
So good. I want to talk about Ben's point, which I disagreed with in the group chat, and then watching the movie, I'm like, no, this is 100% accurate.
Oh, yeah. Ben, explain the point.
It's a movie that sets up to be about this friendship between Haley and what's the other? Is it her name also Haley? Haley Lou?
Please hold.
In real life.
Haley Lou is the character.
It's Haley
name.
And Haley.
They're both the Haleys. Haleys.
They're both actresses. Like the two Jakes.
Yeah. What are their names in the movie?
Names in the movie are Nadine and Krista.
Nice. Nadine and Krista. You are set up to believe that it's going to be a movie about their friendship and the way that it's torn when Krista starts sleeping with and dating Nadine's brother. But really, it becomes about Nadine finding herself through a man.
The restorative powers of heterosexual coupling.
Heterosexual
it's
coupling.
It's a big oof of
it's
an ending.
It's just like, Chris is like, we can talk later.
That's right.
She leaves.
We don't need to get into it. I disagree that the film is saying that it's about female friendship. I don't agree with that. But I do think it leaves that thread unresolved and it should resolve it.
Yes.
But
I think it should be the final resolving
I agree. But it is a credit to Woody Harrelson's richly felt and like kind of subversive in many ways performance that when he's like, When she is at his home at the end of the movie with his wife and child, and it's the scene of domestic bliss, he's like, it's hope or whatever. Or like the wife says it, but he's like, you can have this too. Yeah. It's like, maybe she doesn't fucking want that.
Yeah.
To change diapers and boil carrots for dinner. Fuck that. There's nothing about that character that makes me think she wants to settle down in the next couple of years.
Yeah.
Or settle down ever.
Yeah.
I hate the trope of, well, this guy has liked me the whole time, so I'm going to...
Erwin, who is an incel.
Who is an incel?
Yeah, dig into that more, because I very much agree.
Yeah, so
on second watch, on first watch, I was in
I still am in lust,
but no longer in love, because his personality is shit.
Correct. Well, it's not even... It's the way that he reveals his personality through his art. So at the end of the movie, she goes to the student film festival that he has an animated film in.
Which it blows.
It fucking sucks.
Why is anyone applauding it?
It is the worst third act student-made movie I've seen since Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
LOL.
I hate that movie. So the animated short is about a perfect male alien mm-hmm. who is a perfect gentleman, nothing but accommodating to this beautiful alien girl who he loves, and she rejects him, and he tries harder, and she rejects him, and she leads him on and rejects him,
yeah.
and then he saves her from a monster, and then she tries to kiss him right at the end, and he's like, no, fuck you, and then he goes to a pool, which is his pool in his backyard, which is a callback to him and Haley skinny or like swimming, and she pretends to want to have sex with them
yeah.
with all these busty babes, and then the girl's all sad or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's a total incel thing. It's like yeah. in Irwin's mind, he's like, I want a relationship. I want love, and I'm yeah. worth it, and I'm giving it out there. I'm a good guy, but goddamn women just won't reciprocate it because they can have anyone they want, and they want to take advantage of me and take yep. my love and stomp on mm-hmm. it. And it's just like, that literally makes you an incel.
Yes.
Irwin yeah. is an incel. Hashtag, yes. hashtag Irwin is an incel.
That's right.
The pool scene when she like says, let's have sex. And then it's like, just kidding. And he's like, oh.
He says, you can't say that to a man.
You can't say that to a man.
Which, by the way, I think the film agrees with him on some level.
I think so. She's made to look like the asshole in yeah. that moment.
He literally plays a song that says you're a dickhead and you're meant to like agree that she's a dickhead. And it's like, well, no.
She got her comeuppance. I think that everyone treats her very unfairly throughout this movie and then is more interested in redeeming those other characters than mm-hmm. it is her.
Correct.
She's meant to learn a lesson that she is the dickhead at the end of this movie and that she has to be better. And like, yeah, who doesn't need to get better in their mm-hmm. teenage years? And Haley Steinfeld's performance, which is so fucking good, mm-hmm. and is doing everything it can to like repel you, the audience.
Yeah.
But she still manages to keep you on her side. Like some of the things she says, something I love about the script of this movie is just the disgusting things she says, which are not written in a way, in my opinion, to be like John Hughes clever. They're written in a way to talk about how teenagers converse in hyperbole that is often grotesque, mm-hmm. Sort of as a mode of pretending to have a personality or making up for parts of themselves that they aren't comfortable sharing or like, yeah, exactly that. Like rather than be vulnerable and say, you hurt me, say you're going to get AIDS or something, which mm-hmm. I don't like that's one of the things that gets thrown around.
Oh yeah. That line was a little yeah. weird,
but you know, I still like this movie on the whole and it's mostly because of Haley Steinfeld's performance and Woody Harrelson's performance.
Pop sensation and Academy Award nominee.
I know I told you guys, but I don't think I said on the mic, but I was... No, I did say on the mic already that I was at a GLAAD event and saw her perform and screamed, Edge of 17, mm. and she was like, what? Nice. I rattled her.
I
she
love that. Thrilled. Yeah, I like this movie a lot. It's just not great.
Yeah. How are we on time?
It's just very commercial.
We have 20 minutes to talk about Fat Girl.
I was going to say, this is the moment we've all been waiting for to talk about Catherine Breillat's Fat Girl.
A film we all agree on.
Yes.
Fat Girl.
Fat Girl.
My
Fat
favorite girl. Movie of all time. I'm also next to Mission Impossible Fallout.
By the way, Mission Impossible Fallout would be a great alternate title for Fat Girl.
Oh. Oh, fuck.
When she falls out of the car. The car.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Exactly.
Where
do you guys want to start with this?
Because the axe in the head.
Do you want to start with the axe in the head?
Yes.
Okay, go for it.
Because it's funniest great. Thing I've ever seen.
It's so jarring. You know, like... Something's got to happen. Never,
yeah, well, it's been building this tension with the drive on the
Something's
highway.
Something's got to release.
The trucks that are just
it's
zooming
so
past.
So ominous.
Yes.
My favorite, and I mean, this is where I really, and I don't, I understand it, that there's this cruel sense of humor, and I laughed plenty throughout the movie. I didn't laugh when she got axed in the head. I gasped and then was like, fuck yeah. But when I did laugh was when they are like the three of them are taking a little pit stop mm-hmm. and the two sisters are off while Anais is puking and the mom is like at the car. She's like, come on, we gotta go. And then all of a sudden like a truck just like whooshes right
you
past
think
her.
She's gonna get
you think
fucking...
she's gonna get hit in the head like she's gonna get steamrolled Mary Louise Parker style in Red Sparrow.
Oh, fuck. I forgot.
Yeah, you think she's going to get plowed yeah. down.
I mean, that is when I bust a gut in this movie.
Like, you always, someone's going to, something's happening.
Yeah, but it's hilarious.
And she's, the accident you know, it's, well. You know, something is coming because she's been talking the whole movie that
she wants her first time to not be special. She wants, and they park, and you're like, oh, she's going to get out of the car. She's
and get in with raped. The truck driver. Or something.
Like, she's going to have a moment. This is going to happen. And then it's not what you think. And I still think it's just so
I find it quite horrifying funny. What you're talking about.
Someone looks through the windshield.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's jarring.
Just in one motion, jump through the windshield and smacks the sister with the axe in the face.
It's
and the
literally
mom is
one
not awake yet.
Right. Well, that's why I actually don't think any of this happens.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's a dream, but I'm saying that it is sort of an ecstatic expression of hyperbole where we leave reality, in my opinion. Like when the mom doesn't wake up. You're telling me the mom doesn't wake up when the windshield is shattered? She only wakes up when someone's choking the life out of her. Like, I don't necessarily think this happens. I think that if it can happen. Like, I still accept it in the reality of the movie, and on that level, it becomes even more like cosmically cruelly funny. But I think that the movie does end when they park in the rest stop, and that this is all Anais's fantasy.
That is really interesting. Read it as real, but
which you can. Yeah. You totally can.
But that's interesting to read it as her fantasy.
Well, because and you know, this is the only
as someone who also has violent sexual fantasies.
I know, and
I really love
that's
that.
What I was thinking about. And I was thinking about Belle de Jour, about these sexually humiliating circumstances that the Catherine Deneuve character works out through in her head. Which, as a viewer, you're like, oh my god, like. Yeah. Someone saved this woman, but it is her own sexual fantasy. And that's how I think, that's how I redeem the fairly repellent act that ends the film with her being raped in the forest. I mean, it's very hard to watch and vile and absolutely makes a feminist point once we get around to it. But
what does she say? What are you going to do? Not believe
she
me?
She says you don't have to believe me, or like believe me or don't, or something like that.
Which is such an interesting.
Well, especially right
on.
Now. I mean,
it is interesting that they would probably just assume she's been raped.
Mm-hmm.
But she's saying, like, I wasn't.
Because she's consented.
She claims to. She wants it. She will believe that she wants it.
And this is like so tricky to even talk about because she's still a child. She doesn't. You can't consent.
Yeah.
That there's no such thing as consent in that case.
Even in France, where the age of consent is 16.
I think you're just born with the age of consent. But yes.
But yeah, and like that's what the man with the rock hard cock says to the sister.
That's the next topic.
You're not 16, so we can't do this.
Yeah.
But fully in his heart, he knows he's going to do it. He just feels like he has to say that.
That's a formality to say.
What I love
the hot Italian.
What I love about the rock hard penis. What I love about the rock hard cock, and it's like a 15-minute sex scene.
That middle section, is so long.
But what I love
there are two long sex scenes.
Yeah.
The first one is longer, and they like comprise like 70% of the movie.
And what I love about it is that it's all told from Anais's gaze.
Yeah,
and that when we do a reverse shot, she's like, you can see her in the background. Anais is all over this.
Yeah,
and that really, I think,
I don't think the camera ever goes over to the other side of the bed.
It does, and you see her faking, you know, pretending to be asleep.
But we never get a reverse of just the lovers.
No. They're in the shot, but so
no,
is
no.
Anais.
But I mean, without her, we never.
No. That's my whole point.
Yeah, like, I know.
This all it goes to show Bray's skill with simplicity, because to only have be covering this very lengthy, very quite substantial scene in the film from essentially two angles, and still manage to have a character who is not on the bed be the main flavor over a lot of it is quite substantial.
That she's still the lead of the movie, even
though she gets less screen time.
She's not what am I trying to say, she's not the active protagonist in a way, like
the sister
is the one that has things happening.
The sister has the it's not even agency, exactly right,
it's just the things, activities are being done upon her.
She
literally
is a magnet.
Yeah.
She's just
for the
Anais is
cock.
Just observing.
Anais, though, I mean, let's keep talking about the sex because I want to talk about Anais, but we should keep
the
on
hot
this.
Dick.
Oh my god, when that dick emerged,
the oppressive monster dick. I mean, because this whole scene is about patriarchy and about male manipulation and about subjugating women.
Yeah,
and subjugating women from a young age, mm-hmm. so that they expect this to be the world they're living in, not something to question, but as just the way things are. Mm-hmm. It's very disturbing.
When
Zero.
He coerces her into anal. I was like, oh, of course he would do that.
When he talks about, when he's saying, I wouldn't do it if I didn't love you, and I'm not going to love you if you don't consent. Mm-hmm. And also, all these guys are going to want to take advantage of you. By doing it with me, you're actually getting to take care of this very important step in your life with someone you can trust.
And that, like,
which is, of course,
if you don't do this,
like,
I'm
going
to have to go get off somewhere
else. Exactly. With someone else.
Right, so it's like a threat that, like,
making
well,
her feel
I'm gonna leave
like the
you.
Most and the least important person.
Right,
it's so fucking.
It's so gross, and so violent and mm-hmm. and brutal and wicked. Like, it's so hard to watch, and she forces you to watch it, but you're watching it through Anais's gaze. Mm-hmm. So there is.
I'm literally the cover as I watch the movie.
Yeah, with your hand covering your face.
Yes.
I love the scene of her on, not the diving board, but on the little platform over the pool, and she's just, like, coating her legs in sunscreen.
Oh, it's so good.
So funny.
So much sunscreen.
But I have so much empathy for Anais, the way that everyone in her family hates her.
Truly.
I like how the, it's either
the mom.
She's
the fat girl.
Exactly. Right.
The mom or the dad, or maybe both of them, they simultaneously.
You're eating again?
They simultaneously. Tells her she eats too much, but then also, like, tells her to eat more at the same, like, eat more because it'll make you feel better. You're eating again?
Yeah. Well, it's all about control. I mean, when she and her sister, and also, like, the movie has this tenderness to it in the scene where she and her sister are in bed together after they've made up from their fight and they're laughing and everything and talking about how the older sister used to play mommy. And then once Anais got to a certain age that she couldn't be manipulated, she started to hate her.
Yeah.
And the same thing goes for their actual mother. Like, that's what they don't like about Anais. It's like, she is at an age now where she actually can assert herself and be herself.
Right.
And they want to subjugate her and keep her down.
And it's like, they won't let the sister talk shit about her weight. They're going to be like, well, she has... Doesn't he say she has a chemical thing? Like, there's...
I think maybe.
Like, there's a reason. Like, she just... That's just her body composition or whatever. But it's like, then the mom will still be like, you're eating again? And, like, it's very much about just, like, what they think they're supposed to do. And then there are these moments of what they really feel.
Yeah, and they're just... drilling this deep sense of shame into her, which is another reason why I think that it might be sort of a fantasy escape at the end, because she is sometimes subtly, sometimes very on the nose, being pummeled by everyone else in the family, being shamed, being taken advantage of, being ignored.
Yeah.
All she wants to do is feel herself. She wants to cut that skirt, that dress, all the way up to her mid-thigh. You know, like, that. She just wants to feel herself and do what she wants to do, and everyone is trying to keep her down.
Yeah.
So by the end of the movie, it's just sort of reached a boiling point within her.
It's very cathartic.
Exactly, and that's why I think it feels so cathartic. Whether or not, it doesn't have to be a dream for it to be cathartic, but because of that pent-up, repressed fury.
It's an explosion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the movie has this tremendous sense of potential energy as it goes on, and then once we're on the road, Breillet starts whipping it up and into charging the scene for the kinetic axe murdering moment at the end.
When
need a still of that?
I just can't get over when she falls out of the car.
That Bloop. Is funny.
That is comedy.
Just plopping on
and
the
it's
concrete.
So brilliant that she has a
brilliant
a two door car.
Yeah,
because then she has to
maneuver
over the body,
and then the body falls. Oh my god, it's just brilliant. I just can't get over it. It is just, and it's like the door is there. It's like not even seen. You see her sort of fall, and there's a sound effect. It's genius. It's just genius.
What do you guys think about the shot in the second sex scene when we do leave the lovers and we go over to Anais on the bed and she is sobbing? What do we make of this?
I
haven't really thought about it.
I like made a mental note of it, but haven't really unpacked it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It's upsetting. What is she?
For me, it's the moment in eighth grade when Kayla has that moment in the car. Because, like I'm saying, Anais is all over that sex scene. Mm-hmm. It's the moment when she realizes she's too young for this. That she doesn't know. That she's not sexually mature. That she doesn't... You know, Anais is often, like, the smartest person in the room.
Right.
But she's actually not. She's a child. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to being confronted with something as real, not just as sex, but of rape, which is what's happening.
Right.
It's too much.
Yeah.
She's the carbon sink of the movie. This, and I'm done with the eighth grade comparison. She's the carbon sink of the movie. And this is when she has hit her rupturing point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love this movie.
It just made me so sad.
It's sad. It's a troubling scene.
I didn't really intellectualize what I think it means. I was just, that was probably the saddest
I was. I thought a lot about it afterwards.
It was probably the saddest I was in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something you just said reminded me about
bless you.
When after the the anal sex scene in the morning, she walks the Italian to the door out to the gate outside, and she wants to blow him at that point, but the Italian won't let her because now it has become a control situation and he is the patriarchy and it's no long, he doesn't want it right now.
Right.
So he's,
or maybe he does, but if he does, it's on his own terms.
Yeah, he's going to humiliate her instead and be like, "No, you're going to get pneumonia. Get off your knees." And
in the guise of, "I'm trying to help you,"
yes,
but I'm actually gaslighting you.
But really, I just want to leave.
Yeah, uh-huh.
He just wants to go at this point.
Yeah,
he wants to do the sex later. He has a day. He has a day planned. Maybe he's a man. He has places to be.
He
has people to talk to. He's a lawyer. He's going to be. He's, I don't remember.
I love his mother.
I love his mother, too.
When she storms in, like, where's my ring? My precious.
Oh, yes. My the precious. Ring.
How would he give it to her? How could she accept it? Oh, brilliant.
Love brilliant. This movie.
Brilliant.
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 Nice.
Trying to think of how Jean Dielman fits into all of this.
The length of this episode.
It as had, I already what, said. What are we, like, 90 minutes?
No, I just already made that joke.
90.
Oh.
Remember?
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Come on.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm exhausted. It's been a long week.
I have a stuffy nose.
Oh, are you sick?
You sneezed. You need to... Wait, are you sick?
Yeah, a little bit.
I was sick earlier this
away.
Week.
Stay away.
I probably have whatever, or I've already had whatever you have right now.
I think we have the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, this has been another episode of Movies IMO. I am running to go get a face mask at CVS across the street so I don't catch this bug.
Oh, well,
you gotta go.
I should have said something.
I gotta go.
Just get an ibuprofen patch. I don't know probably how fine. That specifically will help.
Honestly, I'm probably...
I just want the numbness of the ibuprofen patch on my
just,
body.
Just right there.
Yeah.
So I never got into a nicotine patch, but that would be sort of the idea sure. to just like... numb out that place that's on my right. chest. I'm probably gonna get, if y'all are sick, there's something going around and I've been interacting with literally hundreds of people.
I do think it was
week.
From
I'm in Hollywood
that
yeah
you
exactly
will,
exactly
you will it's, become it, ill.
Film festivals are incubators for germs.
Yes,
any
it's just like we're
gathering
all
places.
Together
yeah
yes
for days.
So I'm probably gonna get sick in the next couple of days. I'm just
once
that it
it's like
race
for once impact. It's Monday and like you are no longer working
yeah
and the adrenaline
well, the
leaves
thing.
Your body
yeah that's the other thing yeah.
It's like when you're on a movie set, everyone gets sick the day after
exactly,
you
exactly.
every single
that's
person
what I was gonna say.
There's
yeah.
just like something there's a psychosomatic thing that you know you can't get sick yet
yeah
but it will happen. It's going to happen.
It's going to happen to you to you. And we are on Twitter.
Oh,
that was a bad segue.
I
mean, we'll just
good.
Let's just get
I
it out
like it.
We'll just get it we'll it. Just get it out of the way. We're Movies IMO. You can find us on Twitter at Movies IMO. Please leave us a 5-star review on the iTunes store with the hashtag Irwin is an incel. We will read it. We will read it on the podcast. Oh, we got a very nice review from someone whose name I will look up on the next episode. But thank you for the nice review. And I'm Daniel Crook. I do it now, right?
Sure.
Okay, I'm Daniel Crook. You can find me on the internet at Daniel Crook with 3 O's. And I'm looking forward to sailing away to an Outfest event with Brandon after this.
Well, nice. I'm just kidding. I'll go.
Please. Okay.
I'm sick, but
well,
I'll go.
Well, actually, if you're sick and you don't want to go, that's fine.
Let me decide.
Okay.
I'm Brandon Kirby. I'm deciding whether or not I'm going to this event. And you can find me on Twitter at BK Kirby.
I'm Ben MB. You can find me on Twitter at Real Todd Haynes. I have some very exciting news, which is that Mother has unblocked me on Twitter.
Wait, what?
I was...
It's weird that she like sought you out to
unblock
you.
It's weird that I just mentioned her in a tweet.
Did you?
And then she seems to unblock you. That's a weird causality.
Yeah. So I don't know.
I'm taking credit is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's fine. I was looking through someone's likes, as one does when one stalks
someone. Never done that, but I hear that I should.
Yeah.
I hear that it's useful.
Yeah.
It is.
And I saw a Christine Vachon tweet, and I was like, if she's blocked me, this shouldn't be here. So I clicked on it, and I don't follow her anymore because that's what happens when someone blocks you, but I can see her profile now.
I'm sure that she was going through her block list and was like, oh, this isn't, this boy's not trying
I truly think she was in a drunken rage.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
because all she does is drink.
You know,
it's
what?
It's common wisdom.
You know what she's drinking. This was my tweet. No.
Oh.
No.
Oh.
My tweet is based on the only thing she tweets about, which
red
is
wine.
Anytime she is in an airport lounge, she reviews the free Sauve Blanc and the snacks. And most of the time, it's not a positive review.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
The amount of time she has alliterated subpar Sauve Blanc, that's my next tattoo.
Nice.
The tweet was basically like those stupid contests you see with like celebrities and their white signs that are like, come get dinner with me. Like the only time I would enter one of those if it was Christine Vachon saying, come drink bad Sauve Blanc with me in an airport lounge. Like, that sounds fun.
I love that.
That sounds fun because she's still going to get drunk. This is officially slander, but love, my dream,
what happened is that Phyllis Nage, who follows me,
was like,
Christine. Have you seen this kid who is at Real Todd Haynes? Because sometimes she does interact with my tweets. I assumed for a while I was muted, but now every once in a while she'll do a fave.
Nice.
So I wonder if that's my goal. That's my imagination. Yes. Christine Vachon was like, oh, I've blocked him. That's weird.
My mistake.
Yeah.
I'm going to have some of these subpar pierogies.
As I unblock this boy.
This young faggot.
Unblock all the young faggots.
I'm so glad that my at is Real Todd Haynes, so that when I said that, I remembered the anecdote that I wanted to bring up.
Excellent.
How great.
How useful. Here's to mother. Let's raise a glass of our empty bottles and glasses and pretend it's full of
water.
Pretend it's full of subpar Sauve Blanc and let's clink and let's call it a night.
Great.
Wait, what are we talking about next week?
Oh. Hold on. Yeah, we'll clink at the end. Next week, we are talking about David Lynch's Twin Peaks, The Return.
Next week, we are talking about Mission Impossible Fallout. No, I'm sorry.
No, it is Twin Peaks.
We're recording three episodes within a week. I got confused.
Should we release, we can talk about this off mic, but maybe we should release Fallout before The Return.
No.
We could release it, though, on the Monday after its opening.
No,
it doesn't
because
matter.
We recorded on Sunday.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good. Oh, and I won't have... Okay, it's all good. Wait, we're recording it to next Sunday.
Next Sunday.
Okay, great. All right, here's to Christine Vachon, everybody.
Clink, clink, clink. Mwah.
The winner is Jane Fonda.
Thank you. Thank you very much, members of the Academy, and thank all of you who applauded. There's a great deal to say, and I'm not going to say it tonight. I would just like to really thank you very much.